Glories to Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, reading from Canto 2, Chapter 7, Text 21. Dhanvantaris cha Bhagavan Swayam Eva Kirtir Namna Nirnam Puru Rujam Ruja Asu Hanti Yagne cha Bhagam.
Did I get it right?
Bhagam Amritayor Avavadudha Avavadudha Ayusa Vedam Anusasti Avatirya Loke Dhanvantarischa Bhagavan Swayam Eva Kirtir. Dhanvantarisha Bhagavan Swayam Eva Kirtir. Namna Nirnam Pururujam Ruja Ashuhanti. Namna Nirnam Pururujam Ruja Ashuhanti. Yajne cha bhagam amritayor asavarundha. Yajne cha bhagam amritayor avavarundha. Ayusavedam anusas yanu yavatir yaloke. Ayusavedam anusastyavatirya loke. Dhanvantarischa Bhagavan Swayam Eva Kirtir. Namna Nirnam Pururujam Ruju Ashuhanti. Yajne cha bhagam amritayor avavarundha. Ayusavedam anusast yavatir yaloke.
Others, please.
Oddities? Dhanvantari, the incarnation of God named Dhanvantari. Cha and Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead. Swayameva, personally, himself. Kirti, fame personified. Namna, by the name. Nirnam Puru Rujam, of the diseased living entities. Rujaha, diseases. Ashu, very soon. Hanti, cures. Yagne, in the sacrifice. Cha, also. Bhagam, share. Amrita, nectar. Ayu, duration of life. Ava, from. Avarunde, obtains. Ayushya, of duration of life. Vedam, knowledge. Anusasti, directs. Avatirya, incarnating. Loke, in the universe. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The Lord, in His incarnation as Dhanvantari, very quickly cures the diseases of the ever-diseased living entities simply by His fame personified. And only because of Him do the demigods achieve long lives. Thus, the personality of Godhead becomes ever glorified. He also exacted a share from the sacrifices, and it is he only who inaugurated the medical science or the knowledge of medicine in the universe. Report. As stated in the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, everything emanates from the ultimate source of the personality of Godhead. It is therefore understood in this verse that medical science or knowledge in medicine was also inaugurated by the personality of Godhead in His incarnation, Dhanvantari. And thus, the knowledge is recorded in the Vedas. The Vedas are the source of all knowledge, and thus knowledge in medical science is also there for the perfect cure of the diseases of the living entity. The embodied living entity is diseased by the very construction of his body. The body is the symbol of diseases. The disease may differ from one variety to another, but disease must be there just as there is birth and death for everyone. So, by the grace of the personality of Godhead, not only are diseases of the body and mind cured, but also the soul is relieved from the constant repetition of birth and death. The name of the Lord is called Bhavosiddhi, or the source of curing the disease of material existence. Omagina Tamananda Shajananjana Shalakaya Chakshuna Militamiena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitamiena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swaparantikam. So, there's not a lot more about this particular incarnation, Dhanvantari, in the Bhagavatam. There is a bit more in the eighth canto. He appears actually in the eighth canto, chapter 8, which is entitled The Churning of the Milk Ocean. And the background story there is that the demigods and the demons were fighting. Nothing new. And at one point, the demigods were kind of feeling, well, these guys are getting the upper hand. The demons, they're getting the upper hand here. So they went to Lord Vishnu, and they, you know, presented their case. They said, hey, we got a problem. What should we do? And Lord Vishnu said, okay. He gave him a strategy. He said, look, go back there and ask him, see if he can negotiate a truce. You know, tell him, and the motive behind it would be, look, you know, why we shouldn't be knocking our brains out, killing each other here or fighting each other. Let's work together, churn the ocean of milk, and we'll produce nectar so we could all live eternally. Something like that. And so the demons bought into that. They said, okay, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do it. So they got together and they went to the ocean of milk and they made different arrangements and they were churning away. And at one point, Dhanvantari came out. And this is, I'm going to read about his appearance. So it says here, this is chapter 8, text 31, starts, O king, thereafter, while the sons of Kashyapa, both demons and demigods, were engaged in churning the ocean of milk, a very wonderful male person appeared. He was strongly built, his arms very long, stout, and strong. His neck, which was marked with three lines, resembled the conch shell. His eyes were reddish, and his complexion was blackish. He was very young. He was garlanded with flowers, and his entire body was fully decorated with various ornaments. He was dressed in yellow garments and wore brightly polished earrings made of pearls. The tips of his hair were anointed with oil, and his chest was very broad. His body had all good features. He was stout and strong like a lion, and he was decorated with bangles. In his hand he carried a jug filled to the top with nectar. This person was Dhanvantari, a plenary portion of a plenary portion of Lord Vishnu. So he's an expansion of an expansion. He was very conversant with the science of medicine. And as one of the demigods, he was permitted to take a share in the sacrifices. So that's interesting. So that explains what's meant here in the translation of today's verse where it says, he also exacted a share from the sacrifices. That's explained here that he was considered one of the demigods, so he was permitted to take a share in the sacrifices. When exactly that happened, I don't know, because as you'll see here, he just appeared, and before you know it, this is what happens. Upon seeing Dhanvantari carrying the jug of nectar, the demons, desiring the jug and its contents, immediately snatched it away by force. And so Madhvacharya actually makes some sort of a comment about that. He says, Dhanvantari was carrying the jug containing nectar. Dhanvantari, who was carrying the jug containing nectar, was a plenary incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But although he was very strong, the asuras were able to take the jug of nectar from his hands. And that's pretty much all there is about Dhanvantari. And nobody, don't get upset that the asuras were able to take the jug from his hands. It was all part of a bigger plan that Krishna had to kind of set things back in the right order. So, now as far as today's verse goes, I'm going to try to work through the translation of the purport and kind of comment on different things. So it says, the Lord in his incarnation of Dhanvantari very quickly cures the diseases of the ever-diseased living entities simply by his fame personified. So in this purport, Prabhupada's talking about disease on two different levels. He's talking about material disease of the body, And he's also talking about the spiritual disease, how the, you know, the souls are an illusion, they're conditioned by the three modes of material nature. He's alluding to that as well. It's pretty obvious that he is, especially in the latter part of the purport. So I think here, it's in this first sentence, it's more referring to the, you know, the latter. It's referring to the disease of being an illusion, because it says here, he quickly cures the diseases of the ever-diseased living entities. I mean, sometimes we have physical diseases, sometimes we don't when we're here in the material world. But the entire time we're here in the material world, we're suffering from the disease of illusion. So that's, we're ever diseased in that sense, that we're always an illusion. And he, so Dhanvantari quickly cures that simply by his fame personified. So I really, I know what fame is, but I don't, I couldn't really kind of understand what would fame personified be. But anyway, the way I make sense out of this first sentence is that Krishna is the cause of everything. And Dhanvantari is an incarnation of Krishna. So he's also the cure of everything. You know, and everything's emanating from Krishna, the problems and the solutions. So in that sense, Dhanvantari is the the cure of the disease of the ever conditioned living entity, the ever diseased living entity. So the main disease is, you know, we know is that we're an illusion. The living entities here in this material world are in illusion. They're under the influence of the three modes of material nature, and the way they become free from that illusion is knowledge. And that's nicely described in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, a famous verse where Krishna is explaining how to become free from this disease of illusion. Tadvidi paripattena paripashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tatvadarshana. Krishna says he recommends just try to learn the truth by approaching a bona fide spiritual master. Inquire submissively, render service to him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you. Upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tatvadarshana. He can enlighten you because he has seen the truth. And then in the next verse, Krishna says, yajgyat va na punar moham evam yasya sipandava yena bhutani asheshani drakshyasyatmani atomai. Then he goes on to explain, and when you have received that knowledge, you know, then you will become free from illusion. You'll understand that all living beings are within me, part of me, mine. It's like you'll understand the reality, which is that your spirit souls, you're all parts and parcels of me, like that. So that's how Krishna, in general, and specifically as Dhanvantari, cures the disease of the ever-living, ever-diseased living entities by knowledge. And Prabhupada sort of refers to this a little bit in the very last part of the purport here. He says, so by the grace of the personality of Godhead, not only are the diseases of the body and the mind cured, which of course they are, and we'll talk about that a little bit in a second, but also the soul is relieved from the constant repetition of birth and death. See, that's the result. That's the result of receiving that knowledge from the self-realized soul and understanding what Krishna was describing there, that you become free from the constant repetition of birth and death. Now, then Prabhupada in the next sentence gets a bit more specific in exactly how to, that's going to happen. He says, the name of the Lord is also called Bhavosodhi, or the source of curing the disease of material existence. So that Bhavosodhi, that word also appears in a song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he goes, jeev jago, goda chandra, bole, kota nidra, jayo maya, pisachira kole. I don't know if this is the next part. I think maybe the next stanza, the next slok or line or the one after that is third one. Okay. Enechi osodi. Osodi. Enechi osodi maya. Nasi bado lagi. Harinama mahamantra lao tumi magadet. Lord Chaitanya, Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaking in the voice of Lord Chaitanya says, I have brought the medicine, the osodi. I have brought the osodi, the medicine which will wipe out the disease of illusion from which you are suffering. And that's the Maha Mantra. And he's advising and recommending, encouraging. Take the Maha Mantra. So that's what Prabhupada's saying here. That the name of the Lord is the Bhava. So it's the medicine to get us out of the Bhava, the repetition of birth and death. It's the medicine specifically for that purpose. It's the source of curing the disease of material existence. So that's there. Now, Prabhupada also mentions in this purport, he's talking about material diseases, and he's talking about how, you know, Dhanvantari or Krishna is the source of this. In this verse, it says, it's understood that this verse, the medical science or knowledge and the medicine is also inaugurated by the personality of Godhead. Well, all knowledge, of course, is coming from Krishna, and this is an aspect of it. One, it's just an interesting point on this. Prabhupada, I once heard him say in a lecture that every herb, every plant, well, he said, I think we specifically said herb, has some medicinal value, but people have lost the knowledge. You know, it's so it's, you know, part of the Ayurveda, but it's just modern man doesn't know. So, yeah, and on this point of, and a little further on it goes here that in the translation, only because of him, referring to Dhanvantari, do the demigods achieve long lives. Well, it's only because of Krishna that, what to speak of long lives, the demigods and long lives, it's only because of Krishna that anybody achieves any lives. You know, nicho nichanam chetanas chetananam, Krishna's is eko bahunam yovadadati kaman. That's among so many living entities, there's one supreme, eternal living entity who's supplying the necessities of life for all the other living entities, right? But even beyond that, you know, even beyond that understanding, which is a mouthful to start off with, you have another verse in the seventh chapter where Krishna says, Matak paratanam nanyat kinchit asti dananjaya mayi sarvam idam protam sutre manigana iva. He says, there is no truth superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung upon a thread. So in other words, it's not that Krishna is just supplying the necessities of life for all living entities, which he is, but all existence entirely depends upon Krishna. And Krishna gives a nice metaphor, his own metaphor, to help us understand that. Pearls strung on a thread. So if you know, I don't know a lot about it, but I did ask a few women about this. And apparently pearls are not strung on a thread like japa beads are strung on a japa mala. You know, on japa mala, between each bead there's a knot, and then there's another bead, and then there's a knot, and there's a knot. With pearls strung on a thread, it's just like loose. You know, you got the thread or the necklace or whatever you call it, and then there's the pearls, and they're just kind of dangling. You know, you can swish them around from one side to the other. There's no knot in between each pearl. See? So with that arrangement, if somebody were to cut that necklace, if you cut that thread, then what happens? Yeah, the whole thing falls, scatters. Everything falls apart. So that's a nice, as Krishna's analogy, Krishna's metaphor, that everything rests upon me as pearls are strung upon a thread. You take Krishna out of the picture, forget it. It's, everything goes all over the place. That's no more necklace, you know, no more existence. So Krishna's, you know, that important. And then and it goes on to say here that thus the Supreme Personality of Godhead becomes ever glorified. Well, you know, I'm trying to make sense. When I'm reading these translations and purports, I'm trying to, at least for myself, make sense of everything that's being said. And the way I make sense of that is, Krishna deserves that. In other words, say you know, you're in a situation. Somebody puts you in a great house, gives you a great car, and you got, you know, clothing and food and gives you a bank account with a lot of money in it, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, okay? So do you say thank you to that person once, or do you say thank you to that person repeatedly? You should say thank you to that person repeatedly. So that's the situation, ever glorified. You know, at least the people with intelligence in this universe, the demigods and the, you know, the higher place living entity, the sages above Swargaloka and Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, etc. That's what they're doing. You know, they're ever glorifying Krishna because they're always appreciating. They're conscious. They're mindful of what the real situation is, how we're just dependent upon Krishna. We're, you know, for everything, our very existence, what to speak of all the necessities of life, our very existence. And there are living entities, you know, and as I said, in the more intelligence areas of the universe where they're conscious of that, regularly, and they're glorifying Krishna. Then it goes on to say, well, he also exacted the share from the sacrifices, and it is he only who inaugurated the medical science. Well, we mentioned there he was considered one of the demigods, so he's entitled to one of the sacrifices. And he only inaugurated the medical science or knowledge of the medicine in the universe. So once again, all knowledge comes from Krishna, and it's there, and it's incumbent upon the living entities to take advantage of it. Generally, we don't. But it's there, and it's going to be the best knowledge. And I'll give you an example. If you buy a new car from any company, you know, it comes along with all these manuals, right? You know, they're probably about this thick worth of manuals that you get with any new car you buy these days. I don't know if anybody bothers to read them. But, you know, if anybody knows about that car, you know, what how that this gadget particular works, or how to, you know, how to fix this little thing if it lights up, it's the people who manufacture the car, right? They know that thing inside and out. Now, as I said, nobody bothers. You keep the manuals. Everybody puts them in their glove box, and that's, you know, maybe the last they see of them. But everything, every little detail about that car is in that manual someplace or another, you know, if you fish through it. So in the same way, Krishna has manufactured everything. He's manufactured this whole universe, our bodies, everything. So he knows, and the Vedas contain, it's like the manuals. You know, the car, new car comes with the manual, which gives you every little detail about that car. So in the same way, there's detailed knowledge about every different aspect of life in the Vedic literatures, such as Ayurveda medicine. There's how to fight, the Dhanurveda. There's all sorts of other areas. It's all covered in the Vedas, you know. So Prabhupada says the Vedas are the source of all knowledge. Okay, so I'm going to give an example of that, and this is going to, maybe initially it's going to sound kind of far out, but then I'm going to try to relate it to our philosophy. So here's an example of that from something that catches my attention and interest. So I'm reading from actually a book that Judhakarmapa wrote. It's called Human Devolution, and I'm reading from a little section here called... the title of this chapter is Apparitions, Angels, and Aliens. But I'm just going to read a little section here. So it says here, this is describing an incident that took place back maybe about 50, 60 years ago, a little bit more. So this is speaking now is L. Gordon Cooper, who was an American astronaut at Edwards Air Force Base. Okay, and this is what he said. On this particular day, May 1957 day, he said, I had a camera crew filming the installation when they spotted a saucer. So he was in charge of, they were installing some new type of equipment, and he had a camera crew out there to film the installation of this precision landing guidance system. Okay? So he goes, I had a camera crew filming the installation when they spotted a saucer. They filmed it as it flew overhead, then hovered, extended three legs as landing gear, and slowly came down to land on a dry lake bed! These guys were all pro cameramen, so the picture quality was very good. The camera crew managed to get within 20 to 30 yards of it. That's pretty close. That's like from here to where? Is that like the length of this room? Maybe 20 yards? So that's pretty close. Okay, filming it all the time. It was a classic saucer, shiny, silver, and smooth, about 30 feet across. It was pretty clear it was an alien craft. As they approached closer, it took off. After a while, a high-ranking officer said that when the film was developed, I was to put it in a pouch and send it to Washington. That's what I did when it came back from the lab, and it was all there. Just like the camera crew reported. So, first point is like before somebody gets to this level, you know, becoming an astronaut like that. This is like a very high clearance level. These guys are screened, and you know, they go through a lot of stuff to make sure that you know they're not just like talented, but that they're really kind of sane and you know, these are, at least in the opinion of the mundane authorities, very together guys, you know, to become, and he's in charge of this crew. So he's a pretty credible person. And, you know, this is what he's saying. So my point is that there are hundreds and thousands of reports like this, you know, from different people, many of them kind of on this caliber, you know, certainly, you know, who've been, a lot of them who maybe don't have some sort of official qualification like this, but they, the people submitting these reports have been psychologically and psychiatrically evaluated, and they're found to be completely normal. You know, they're not like nutcases or anything like that, you know. So these reports have been coming in since like 1947. That's about 75 years of sightings of UFOs, of spotting aliens, of even people reporting having even been abducted by the aliens in the UFOs, and et cetera, et cetera. So without getting into a lot of detail about that, so what are the governments around the world, you know, how do they understand that? How do they? Well, they don't. They don't understand it. They have what to speak of being able to explain what the heck's going on with this. They've had a tough time, a really tough time, as evident from, you know, the level of knowledge of the common guy on the street, even owning up to it, even acknowledging that this is really happening, that it's not just a bunch of weather balloons or atmospheric lights or crazy people just kind of, you know, spewing out their psychosis or something like that. They've had a tough time getting past that. What to speak of explaining it, okay? Well, what about us? Can we explain it? Yeah, we can explain it. I'll explain it. Brugopati does. You know, nobody's special, but I'll explain. Okay, so the Vedic literature say that we live in a hierarchically structured universe, right? In the fifth canto, it's described about how the universe is set up. There's, you know, 14 planetary systems, and in the middle, you got Bhumandala, which is our Earth planet is kind of on that, we're on that plane, Bhumandala. So there's six above us, Bhuvar Loka, Swarga Loka, Mahar Loka, Jana Loka, Tapa Loka, Satya Loka, and then below, I don't think I got them in the right order, but there's Talatala, Atala, Sutala, this Tala, that Tala, and, you know, what? Batala. Yeah, there's a bunch of Talas down there. And they're one down. Okay. So they occupy a geographical location in three-dimensional space, but more important than that, these are parallel realities. These are parallel realities. That's an important thing. In other words, we're dealing with something that's more than just extraterrestrial. It's extra-dimensional, and the Vedic worldview supports that. So getting to the point that what are these UFOs? You know, what are these aliens? Well, it's very easily described in the Vedic literature. I mean, I don't take credit for it. Sataputta was the person who first kind of put this forward, and it's kind of Judah Karma seems to be on board with it, and it makes perfect sense to me that these beings are most likely they're from some of these lower planetary systems, such as you know, the just mentioned, the like Sutala or Atala, Talatala, like that. And the beings that inhabit those lower planetary systems, it's described that they have paranormal, they have mystic powers, and they have advanced technology. Okay? But a description of them is that they are predominantly in the mode of ignorance. Okay? So, in other words, they have this technology, you know, they have the UFOs, and they have the mystic powers. So all the things that are described in all these reports that people have been making for the last 70 years are very easily explained within the Vedic picture of reality. Very easily explained within the Vedic picture of reality. I mean, somebody might ask, well, okay, but then why don't they just, if they're so much more powerful than us and they're so much more, you know, technologically advanced and mystical, and why don't they just take us over? Well, they're not able to do that because human beings are protected. It's part of a whole plan. You know, the human form of life is actually special. In the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, it explains how the demigods were actually praying to take birth as human beings, you know, in Bharatvarsha or on Earth, because in one short human lifetime, you can take up devotional service and go back to Godhead. So there's a sense in which the human beings are protected. And, you know, these guys can only do so much. But in other words, the point is that we can very easily explain these things. I mean, I'm not doing maybe the best job at it, but it's once I gave a class here about, I don't know, 10 years ago, something like that, it was a Sunday feast lecture called The Vedic Worldview. It provides the picture of reality that all the pieces of the puzzle of life fit into. And I still stick with that. I said it 10 years ago in a class, and that's exactly, I'm completely confident about that. The Vedic picture of reality provides the Vedic worldview provides the picture of reality that all the pieces of the puzzle of life fit into. You name a piece of a puzzle, you know, mystery, reincarnation. Totally, you know, people in general, what, is that possible? Yeah, there's evidence for it. And it's something that's easily explained by our philosophy. Anatomically, modern human beings appearing in, you know, places in the fossil record where, you know, there's no way they should be there. Once again, you know, yeah, we have anatomically modern human beings appearing in places in the, you know, history going back millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. So everything's explained by the Vedic worldview. So my point is that Prabhupada says here that the Vedas are the source of all knowledge. So we should try to cultivate a mentality of more and more placing our faith in what's stated in the Vedic literatures. You know, we're meant to have implicit faith in this is that verse, Yasya Deve Pada Bhaktir Tata Deve Tata Guru Tashaite Katitakiya Tak Prakashante Mahatmanaha. That only unto those who have implicit faith in the words of the spiritual master, the words of the Supreme Lord and the words of the spiritual master, unto them all the imports of the Vedic literatures are automatically revealed. So in other words, we're supposed to be working at putting implicit faith in that. And we have to, you know, realize that we're not meant to, as devotees, as Prabhupada and Ugas or Rupa, you know, we're not meant to have implicit faith in mundane authorities. It's not that we, you know, totally don't give them any credit for anything. Obviously, they're not total fools, because look, you know, they made this. But in terms of like absolute perfect, no. I mean, for instance, Prabhupada said they didn't go to the moon. That's coming from Srila Prabhupada. He made a lot of statements about that. He made a lot of comments, but one of them was his final thing in 1976 in that they landed in the Arizona desert. So, in other words, we can't place implicit faith. I'm not saying, I'm not a conspiracy theory guy, you know, but at the same time, just, you know, I have to always remind myself, you can't have implicit faith in what mundane authorities say, because that's not our philosophy. That's not us. That's not our line. Whereas we are meant to try to develop implicit faith in what we hear from the Vedic literatures, right? And the process for doing that, once again, is the same process as the process for the babosity of becoming free, relieved of the constant repetition of birth and death. Bhakti yoga, devotional service, very important aspect of that is the chanting. See, so the chanting, if we really, we're meant to take shelter of the chanting, and that's going to not only relieve us from the constant repetition of birth and death, but in the process of doing that, it's going to enlighten us so that we will be able to understand all these different things. We'll get realization. Pratyak shavagamam dharmyam. You know, that this engagement in devotional service gives direct perception of the self. It gives direct perception of this philosophy by realization. See, so, if, you know, if we take the chanting seriously, we're going to be able to. We'll gradually develop more and more conviction that, yeah, everything we're hearing in these literatures is true, bit by bit, you know. We'll acquire that conviction. So, can anybody see what time it is? I've kind of totally lost track of the time. A little after 8:30. Okay, so I guess I should stop there. Does anybody have anything they'd like to say? Speak now, forever hold your peace, as they say at the end of the wedding ceremonies. Ananda Kirtan, one response.
Hare Krishna. So, in the part of the Bhagavatam where you were reading about Dhanvantari coming after the churning of the ocean of milk, one purport, Prabhupada says that if you chant Dhanvantari's name, he frees you from any sickness or any disease in the body. So, as I was reading the Bhagavatam for the first time, at that specific part, I just happened to be catching a cold. So I started chanting his names, but I still caught a cold. So can you explain why I didn't get free from my sickness?
Maybe you didn't chant it enough. I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it's an exaggeration, but I don't know why it didn't work for you. Sorry. Anybody else have anything they want to? Oh, so maybe I should mention that one of our god brothers passed away, Mahashringa Prabhu. Just got news of that earlier today. And I had a little association. I remember Mahashringa, when the first time I went to Mayapur, 1976, he was in charge of serving out of the prasadam. That was all taking place in the, there was only one place where all the devotees took prasadam at that time, and that's when, that was by the wall, as you're on the campus and you're going out to the road there, you get to that wall and you make a left, what's it called, the something kitchen, or I forget what it's called, they all have a name, but anyways, the original place where they served that prasadam, so he was in charge of all the serving out of the prasadam. And I always remembered him like as being, you know, he's very like he was a healthy, well-built guy, you know, very had a lot of energy, and he was also he was like a chaturya, you know, he was kind of he didn't have any problems, just kind of organizing the team and delegating everybody. Okay, you serve this, you serve that. I felt very happy. I used to volunteer every day, and I used to really enjoy working under his direction there, because he was very competent. He loved doing it. You know, he was very enthusiastic about it. He did a great job. And, yeah. So that's just something I always remember him. You know, he was an awesome devotee, you know. And so many, Prabhupada once said, you know, my spiritual master sent you all to help me. So when I think of, you know, people like him, I always think of them in terms of, yeah, this was some special soul that was sent, you know, had some special relationship, was sent to help Prabhupada in establishing his International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He made his contribution, definitely. So, Mahashringa Prabhu Ki Jai. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Too wacky, or did I pull it off?